Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Welcome back to All of It. Exactly 159 years ago, on July 12, 1860, a death row inmate named Albert Hicks was meeting with a priest. Hicks was set to be executed in public the next day on Bledsoe Island, which is now Liberty Island, as in where the Statue of Liberty stands. His hanging would be the last public execution in New York City. Oh, and it was public. Thousands showed up to witness the event because it had become this event after breathless coverage and a long manhunt. So what led to this day? Richard Cohen tells the tale in his new book, The Last Pirate of New York, A Ghost Ship, A Killer, and the Birth of a Gangster Nation. Thanks for coming to the studio.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So when you have to describe who Albert Hicks was, how do you describe him? And then how did he start to run afoul of the law?
Well, I can tell you what he said about himself when asked by a group of reporters. They said, who are you? He said, I'm the worst man who ever lived. And he was a from Connecticut kid, committed a petty crime, was put in an adult prison, was kept breaking out of that prison, ultimately was put in solitary confinement for a year and kind of went crazy and swore in that prison that when he got out, he was going to take his revenge on the entire world. And for 20 years between then and when he was the last publicly hanged man, he did that. He was on whaling ships. He was at the Gold Rush in California. He was all over the world. He confessed all of this in this crazy, almost Gabriel Garcia Marquez could have written this confession. Yeah. It was surreal. And he was a pirate. He would mutiny on ships. He was tried for piracy. And he committed this crime in New York Harbor, which attracted me to it. I wrote a book called Tough Jews about Jewish gangsters. And I came across a story of this guy, Albert Hicks, and he was almost the Paul Bunyan of the underworld. He's almost a mythological figure. And if you talk to gangsters who've talked to gangsters who've talked to gangsters, you get all the way back to this guy. And he committed this crime in the middle of the night, and he attempted to sink this boat full of dead bodies, or he'd thrown the bodies overboard. The ship didn't sink, and in the morning, in a city that was right on the edge of the Civil War, hysterical city already, there's this ship floating in New York Harbor, and they call it a ghost ship, and the police go aboard the ship, and there's no one on the ship, but the whole ship's covered in blood.
It's just a bloody mess.
Yeah. And they bring the ship into South Street Seaport, and the detectives, who are new, go aboard and they search it and they find four severed fingers and a thumb. And that image of that guy who did that and then ran and became this huge tabloid story, crime story in New York. The New York Times really was established by this story, partly. I've been fascinated by it for 20 years, ever since I wrote the first gangster book I wrote.
When we think about what really, the boat is called the E.A. Johnson.
Right.
And explain to people how he committed this act of piracy on this boat, because it's kind of interesting how it became, the boat itself became the ghost ship.
Well, it's interesting because whenever you read about this story, and it's written about in the Herbert Asbury book called Gangs in New York, and it's sort of this, it's always written about that Albert Hicks was shanghaied. That's a term they used at the time, which is a ship would come in short of crew into New York, and a guy would be drinking in a bar, and somebody would go slip a Mickey in his drink. They'd stay in hotels that actually were built on piers. And in the room, there was a trap door. You open the trap door, there's the river. They knock this guy out, take him onto the boat, and he wakes up at sea, and he's told work or swim. And in the worst case, you wind up on a boat to China. You're gone for a year. That's where the term Shanghai came from. And the story was always that he'd been shanghaied. He woke up on the ship out at sea. He became infuriated and killed everybody on the ship. And that appealed to me as this genre of bad people pick on somebody who happens to be even worse than them. One of my favorite genres. So, but actually, when you go back and research it, what really happened is this guy was just a pure predator hunting. And he picked this ship out. It was like the classic movie thing. He was already old. He's 40 years old. A 40-year-old pirate's like a normal person at 95 years old. I mean, the fact that he's still alive is unbelievable. And he was married. He had a newborn baby. And he wanted one more big score to sort of settle down. He lived on Cedar Street, Manhattan. And he picked this ship out because it was an oyster sloop. It had only a four-man crew, including him, so he knew he could handle it.
Yeah, he kind of stalked it before.
Right. Oyster ships carried cash because oysters would go bad. You had to pay in cash, couldn't pay in credit. And he waited till it got out beyond the into the Narrows. And the idea was to originally to sail the ship back up the Hudson River, then called the North River, scuttle it, and just go home onto 14th Street. And to me, like, when is this story set? It's set at the time when there were 14th Streets anchored, pirate ships anchored off 14th Street, basically. But what happened is The ship got run into by another ship in the middle of the night and disabled. And then he had to do this hysterical plan B where he just took everything he could and ran. And as he ran, made a drunken spectacle of himself to the point where they could catch him.
That was amazing in the book that he he did not go by a low profile once he got off the boat. He was throwing money around. Was this just in your mind because he was crazed?
No, I mean, when you look at it from our point of view, it makes no sense. Yeah. Because he's almost like Long John Silver singing 15 Men on a Dead Man's Chest. I mean, he's like such a stereotypical pirate.
Yeah.
But at that point, there was no forensic evidence, no DNA, no fingerprints, no little baggies. So if you weren't caught in the act of committing a crime or with an eyewitness and you got away into a crowd, there was no way to catch you. And basically, I think over 50% of the murders in New York were never even brought to trial. This was there was a huge crime spree in New York right then. This was a time when there was like the Five Points and the Sixth Ward. And he just, you know, it was just another mysterious thing going to be out at the ocean. And he completely acted like a guy who thought he was home free. And it just so happened that the New York City was just starting a new detective department and had this incredibly dedicated detective who wanted not only to catch this guy, but to prove that this could be a science, the art of using evidence to catch somebody. And it turned into this unbelievable, you know, criminal trial of the century of its time in New York, to the point where all the sort of swells from uptown were coming downtown to meet Hicks, who became almost like an anti-hero.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where he's like the birth of the gangster nation, in that he created the type, you know, Al Capone, John Gotti wearing silky yellow socks on Mulberry Street. All that kind of started with this guy, Albert Hicks, who was an unbelievably good-looking guy and a great dresser and charismatic.
One of the things, though, it's so interesting. By the way, my guest is Rich Cohn. We're talking about The Last Pirate of New York, A Ghost Ship, A Killer, and The Birth of a Gangster Nation. Is he messed up. He thought that boat was going to sink.
Right.
He thought he was going to bury the evidence. What happened that the boat didn't sink? He tried.
Well, he was in a big hurry. And it was really, yeah, really grisly. And one of my things is, I'm not normally a person who writes about incredibly grisly things, but it was grisly. And there's the police reports and the court testimony, so you got to kind of confront it. And he basically killed everybody on this ship, and he knew that they were going to come looking for him. So he burned holes in the side of the ship, and there was so much blood and debris in the cabin that the blood flowed out and blocked up the holes. The ship didn't sink, and he threw everybody overboard, but he'd missed these four fingers and a thumb because one of the guys he'd killed, or thought he'd killed, he threw overboard, and the guy reached up and grabbed the railing and held on, and he had to basically chop his hand off to get off the ship. And he left that evidence behind, and he took the little dinghy, and he went ashore to Staten Island, where he sits and waits very publicly for the Staten Island ferry in a little bar next to the ferry, making everybody drink whiskey with him and sing songs.
And then with the death grip. That's what made me think of when you wrote that's where death grip comes from.
Yeah.
One of the things that is also really fascinating about the book, there's a lot of it. You're mentioning that this is sort of the beginning of an investigator trying. I kept thinking this is the Law and Order 1860 part,
right,
of it, right?
Right.
Because they're going to places, they're asking, have you seen this guy? Do you know this guy? They're looking for his wife, who's kind of got some sort of eye issue,
yeah,
and that's a clue they pick up. Did this case, what impact did it have on police work in New York?
Well, it proved that you could sort of, now, they kind of cheated a little bit because ultimately they didn't try him for murder because you needed bodies to try him for murder. He threw the bodies overboard. Now they would probably be able to recover the bodies.
Mm-hmm.
So they tried him for piracy. And that's why he was hung on what is now Liberty Island, because the punishment for pirates is traditional, hanging within sight of the sea. And that's what happened to him. But what it ultimately proved was you could build a case through circumstantial evidence, because that's what it was, and catch a murderer. You didn't need a body, and you didn't even necessarily need an eyewitness. And one of the really remarkable things in the court case is he was caught in possession of this clothing that one of the sailors had, and they brought into the courtroom in Manhattan the sailor's mother who'd made the clothes and identified it. And it's just everyone in the court is crying when she said, I made these clothes. And they actually had, one of the things he had on him was a daguerreotype, a picture of one of the sailor's fiancés. And they brought her up and she had the matching daguerreotype. This is like great evidence. And in the daguerreotype that she had some of his hair. And then they took some of the hair that they found on the boat, because there was some hair in the blood, and they actually had the jury compare I mean, it's very rudimentary. Now you'd have DNA, but they both said, yeah, this looks like the hair from the same head. So it was sort of the beginning of real physical evidence creating this chain to lead to the end result of, in this case, capital punishment.
We forgot one important thing. Explain to our audience how he was caught.
Well, they found him in Providence, Rhode Island. He took off for Providence. He was from Connecticut. He'd been in Rhode Island before. It's where you'd go when you had a lot of money where he grew up. And he was hiding in a rooming house. And they did this amazing thing, which is they were afraid if they told him what he was really wanted for, he would fight him and it'd be a big problem. So they found him in the middle of the night and they told him he was wanted for counterfeiting. And one of my favorite moments in the police report is when they said he's wanted for counterfeiting and he's expecting to be wanted for murder, he starts to laugh. And the detective says, why are you laughing? He says, do these look like the hands of a counterfeiter? And he holds up his hands and the detective goes, no, they don't. Because what they look like is the hands of a pirate.
You touched on this, how he started to become a little bit of a legend and like an anti-hero. And it really speaks to the idea of income inequity is not a modern thing at all. You write about how there was a different system even within the jail, that there were prisoners in the jail who had Louis XIV furniture because they were wealthy.
Right.
There's this great passage I want to read. On the eve of the Civil War, the city was as economically stratified as it is today. The wealthiest New Yorkers, the aristocrats and tycoons, had fled Lower Manhattan, leaving the old blocks to the indigent immigrant Irish, and headed uptown to 4th and 5th Avenues, where in brownstone mansions and townhouses, protected by an ever more modern police force, they created an enclave. It was a different world above 14th Street. Downtown, the poorest had taken over areas abandoned by the rich. Waterfront wards were wooden mansions dilapidated into rooming houses and elegant streets turned into slums. The middle class, small but growing, were squeezed in between. Clerks and merchants, salesmen, physicians, and journalists lived in apartments and houses on 9th and 10th Streets, on 4th Avenue and Broadway, in the 15th and 18th wards of Gramercy Park and Union Square. They dreamed of ascension, the grand move to Upper City, but they feared decline, a slump back into the swamp.
Yeah.
It's so interesting. I mean, one, it's fun to think about like, oh, I know where that exactly
right,
is.
Right, right.
but to think about the economics of the time as well. Was that interesting to you?
Absolutely. I mean, my ancestors came a little later in the next wave, like in the 1880s. They ended up in New York. This was earlier. This is Irish and Germans, and they wind up in an entire neighborhood that's been condemned. That's the 5 points. Where the buildings, because they're built on the remains of an old lake, which was the collect, are all leaning this way and that and filling up with water, and the police won't even go in there because of all the murders. And the idea is people are kind of left to their own, where there's incredible fortunes on one hand, and there's incredible violence and poverty on the other. And you mentioned the Tombs prison, which sits where the Tombs now were replaced. If you were wealthy, they would order in dinner every night. They would have, you know, lobster thermidor for dinner every night. So Albert Hicks became an anti-hero because he seemed to represent almost the slum striking back. He was this sort of demon spirit of the city and the unfairness of the city. And he became so famous that P.T. Barnum, who had his American Museum, went in and asked him if he could make a wax figure of his face to create a wax likeness of him as the worst man who ever lived, which he did. He traded him 2 boxes of 5-cent cigars to make these things for his face and took his actual clothes. And that's what was so interesting to me, to get back to what I said, which is the idea of the Shanghai, that he had been a victim before he'd been a criminal.
Right.
That was almost like, I was wondering, where did that story come from? How did it change? And it was almost like it became this folk legend of almost this righteous criminal. And to make him acceptable that way, you had to make him a victim before. Because if you knew the real story, the real story wasn't at all pretty. He wasn't what you thought he was, but he became something important in the imaginations of people, and he was famous for a long time. I mean, he died in 1860. I found an old New Yorker story from like the 30s where they're interviewing an old hangman from the Tombs who says the execution that he's most proud of is when he killed Hicks the pirate. So now I worked at the New Yorker. That was my first job. I know that if you said Joe Montana, they'd say, comma, quarterback for the San Francisco 49ers.
So Madonna, a singer.
Right. So the fact that it said Hicks, that was it, means that he was really famous and sort of just been forgotten kind of in the last 50 years.
My guest is Rich Cohen. The name of the book is The Last Pirate of New York, A Ghost Ship, A Killer, and the Birth of a Gangster Nation. He denied it for a long time.
Yeah, he had now he had an older brother who'd also been in prison for murder and was awaiting execution and escaped and ran away. And he'd been arrested many times all over the world, and he always got out. And I believed right up until the judge said, you know, you'll hang by the neck till dead. It was either Bedloe's Island or Ellis Island, which was called Gibbet Island, I think. And pirates had been hanged on these islands for hundreds of years, which that's what's like. I have an article about that, about the secret history of Bedloe's Island in the Wall Street Journal this weekend, because it's fascinating to me. Because there's like a picture of Donald Trump in a helicopter looking out at the Statue of Liberty. And I'm thinking, man, if you really knew what was on that island, then underneath the Statue of Liberty was this place where pirates were hung. You couldn't even be a novelist and make it up as far as second layers of symbolism.
Right.
You know, and the fact is he heard them say hung by the neck till dead. It just hit him that I'm not getting out of this one and I'm going to die. And then he began to bargain. Mm-hmm. And he believed, he gave this really chilling interview in the newspaper where he kept saying there were five people on the ship, there were five people on the ship. And the reporter says, stop lying to me, there were four people. And he says, no. He names them all and he goes, and there was the devil. And he believed that the devil was with him all the way, not as like a symbolic thing, but as the actual in-person, the devil. And the devil had betrayed him. And when the priest came, you mentioned the priest at the beginning, was famous for working with people on death row. He said to the priest, basically, is it too late? You know, the devil abandoned me. Can I switch teams at this point? Is it too late for me to go to the good place? And the priest said, no, it's not too late. As long as you admit everything you did and genuinely accept Jesus Christ, it's not too late for you. And that's when he decided to give this wild confession.
He was convicted very quickly. There was no question about whether he was going to be...
7.5 minutes.
7.5 minutes.
I was thinking the movie The Producers, where they say, how do you find? They say, we find the defendant incredibly guilty.
So what was his life like from the time of his conviction to his being hanged?
Well, he wasn't one of the rich prisoners. He had nothing. So he slept on a straw bed in the tombs, in a part of the tombs at the bottom floor called the Murderer's Corridor. And he was surrounded by murderers who were famous for one reason or another. And it was just a stream of wealthy, fancy people coming to his cell to see him. And the guy who sort of ran the whole thing was a federal marshal of New York, who's a wildly colorful figure named Isaiah Rinders, who'd been like a knife fighter and a card sharp on the Mississippi River, ran the Dead Rabbits, one of the big gangs in the Five Points, and helped James Buchanan win the presidential election. And as a reward, was made the federal marshal of New York. And he when he got Hicks, who was this very, very famous person, he saw this opportunity and he sort of did what anybody would do in his situation in charge of a hanging. He sold tickets. Joking, obviously.
Do you know what? This is making me think of El Chapo.
Right. It's thing. Crazy.
Like how big, like the spectacle of it.
Right. And you got to remember, in New York, the federal government did a study. There were 450 pirates living in New York at that time. And this is a city approaching a million people with a lot of crime just before the Civil War, where something like 10% of the people in the city are from the South because of the cotton trade. Mm-hmm. So there's this roiling nature, to this hysterical nature to the city. And he became this celebrity prisoner where everybody wanted to go in and meet with him and talk with him and go back to parties and said they'd met him. And they took him on a steamship out to Bedloe's Island and they sold tickets to the steamship. When he got there at 9 in the morning, it was just full of drunk people because they'd opened the bar at 6 a.m. and the deal was all you can eat oysters, all you can drink beer and for $1 and you could see the killing. Hmm. And 20,000 people went out to watch him be hung. Some of them on Bedloe's Island and 12,000 of them in ships all over the harbor. And that was the last public execution in New York, I think partly because of that execution, because it was meant to sort of be this warning to the people in the slums, you know, which is this is what happens if you do wrong. And instead it turned into this big drunken festival with this hanging as the entertainment.
Now, how is he the conduit between piracy and gangsters?
To me, I always say he's like the missing link. He's, you know, Bluebeard crawls out of the primordial ooze and comes ashore and becomes John Gotti. It's because he operated on both the sea and in the slums, and because he became a model, almost, of how he conducted himself both in his trial and in that period you're talking about, and the incredible stoicism and incredibly cool way, which made him a celebrity, which, as I said, he was very handsome. He was an unbelievable dresser. He was identified almost for his clothing as much as anything else. And so, like, the idea of gangsters in parrot-colored jackets and stuff, that sort of comes from him. He had a suit handmade for his execution that was an electric blue suit with stitched anchors on the sleeves and brass buttons. My alternative title for this book was A Pirate in the Electric Blue Suit. And he became this celebrity. And what amazed me was he was sort of set so much of the style up that we knew all throughout the years that was still existent. The gangsters I wrote about in Tough Jews were Murder Incorporated, guys like Louis Lepke, Buckalter, Bugsy Siegel. Bugsy Siegel is a direct echo of Albert Hicks in the whole way he carried himself. And what interested me was, you know, we all know sort of the history of New York, mayors, governors. This was like this parallel history of the underworld in New York. And this is one of the creators of the underworld of New York. And to me, he's sort of way back to the point where New York is going from being a city all about the sea to a city with other business.
The name of the book is The Last Pirate of New York, A Ghost Ship, A Killer, and the Birth of a Gangster Nation. Rich Cohen, thanks for coming to the studio.
Thank you.
It's a fun read. Coming up next, WNYC culture editor Charlie Herman stops by. We're going to be talking about the moon landing. Stay with us. More after the break.